Our studio is in Vermont. Our antenna is in New Hampshire. We are New Hampshire Monters. This is Black Sheep Radio, WOOL FM, 91.5 Bellows Falls. Community radio for the southern Vermont and New Hampshire borderlands.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hello, Bellows Falls and people listening on the internet in the future. I'm KMO, this is Sea Realm Radio, and today is Sunday, the 22nd of October, 2017, and I am your host, KMO. I have on the line, at least I hope I do, Hunter. Hunter, are you there?
I am. You do have me here.
Excellent.
It's very exciting to be talking to the Vermont-New Hampshire border.
Yes, the new Vermont-New Hampshire.
Exactly. That's a word I'm going to have to really practice.
Yes. It's kind of like singularitarian that way. Doesn't roll off the tongue the first time.
Yeah, there are so many exciting words. I mean, the great thing about the hive mind of the internet is it's constantly challenging our vocabulary by expanding it.
Oh. Hey, Hunter, your last name is spelled M-A-A-T-S, just in case anybody wants to Google you. How is that pronounced?
I usually say it's like the applesauce, Mott's.
Okay.
The applesauce. I'm not the applesauce millionaire, the scion of the applesauce fortune, but it is pronounced the same way.
Well, I have to say that wouldn't be helpful to me because I don't think I'm familiar with that brand. Maybe I'm just not a big applesauce connoisseur.
Yeah, it's Mott is the applesauce.
I see.
So the spelling is different. And I've always wondered if the family got Ellis Islanded or not, and whether it was originally M-A-A-T-S, but the pronunciation is the same.
So before we get into any deep conversation or even trivial conversation, if we want to go that way, I want to tell folks that there is a meeting of the Progressive Party, and then look for the Mid-River Bulletin Board link. Alrighty. Social, local, community obligations discharged. Conversation commences now.
That's so good. Yeah.
Hunter, you are part of a podcasting duo, and the podcast used to bear the name of your co-host, and now it's called Mixed Mental Arts. So say as many or as few words as you'd like about that.
Yeah, so, you know, Brian and I, both of our
Brian,
dads work for
Brian?
Citibank. Brian Callen. I'm sorry. I keep on forgetting that not everybody is familiar with Brian Callen's oeuvre. So, yeah. So, Brian is a stand-up comedian. He was in The Hangover. He was in the old school. You might have seen him on Entourage. He's one of those actors that has floated around Hollywood for a million years. And you're like, oh, yeah, that guy. And, you know, but Brian's dad and my dad both worked for Citibank. And so we had this very unusual childhood where we were constantly moving from country to country to country. And Brian always jokes that, you know, our childhood was seeing great poverty from inside an air-conditioned car. That's pretty spot on. And so we always had a sense of how lucky we are and that it really was just the luck of the draw that we happened to have gotten an American passport, that we had access to, you know, financial resources and education, and so have always been fascinated by those questions and trying to figure out how we would do something to change that. So Brian, because he did have some fame, had this podcast and was just sort of lazily booking porn stars and MMA fighters and comedians because that's what he thought people would be interested in. But at the same time, we were reading all of these books about sort of the big questions. And I was like, Brian, you know, you're kind of famous. You're kind of a big deal. And if we wanted to book some of these authors and professors, we could. And so we started booking all these authors and professors. But in the process, you know, after 200 interviews, we found that most of these academics knew a lot about their little field, but very, very little about what was happening anywhere else. And so we thought that it was time to, you know, piece all these ideas together and package them together. And since Brian was in the mixed martial arts world, we said, well, that's the perfect metaphor. So we changed it to mixed mental arts. Because the idea is to take all those thinking styles, blend them together, and to ultimately evolve a thinking style that is more powerful or more robust than any single academic discipline.
For those who are not followers of the UFC or not really familiar with the notion of mixed martial arts, There was this thing called the Ultimate Fighting Championship, which I think was back in the 90s. I watched it all on VHS. My Tai Chi teacher gave me the early, I don't want to call them episodes, I guess events. And it was at first a competition between different styles of fighting. So you had a boxer in the ring against, you know, a wrestler or a trap shooter, or what quickly became obvious, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was just... a little skinny guy named Royce Gracie dominated three of the first four events and really, you know, established that if you didn't know Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, at least some of it, that you were of no use inside the octagon, which is the ring that the fighters fought in. And then the thing got bought out because it was in financial trouble, and it got purchased by, I think, a bunch of casino owners and a guy who's really into boxing, and they turned it into a sport, you know, with weight classes and things like that. And by that time, it was obvious that there were certain elements that you needed to be able to compete in this sport. You had to know some grappling. You had to have the physical conditioning of a boxer. You needed to know if, you know, even if you weren't going to do submissions, you needed to know how to not get submitted by them. And so it became obvious that you needed a mixture of these various styles of fighting, which used to be separate. And they are no longer separate. And what occurs to me, well, before I get into that, let's flesh out the metaphor between that mixed martial arts and mixed mental arts. What's the comparison to be drawn there?
Well, so for example, take a field like economics. So economics is ultimately, a lot of it is about human decision making. So you're trying to figure out, you know, how do people make financial decisions? Where do they allocate their resources? How can the economy as a whole more effectively do that? So ultimately, you know, in order to do economics, you're having to actually think about neuroscience and psychology. You're having to think about how humans think. But historically, economy as a whole more effectively do that. So ultimately, you know, in order to do economics, you're having to actually think about neuroscience and psychology. You're having to think about how humans think. But historically, economics didn't factor that in. And so what they ended up with was they ended up with these very tidy assumptions about human decision making, which was this idea called rational agent theory, which is that humans behave more or less rationally. And it became very clear in the 70s that that was a terrible, terrible set of assumptions. And so all of this psychology from people like Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky started to move into economics, and you ended up with behavioral economics. Now, in practice, what's happened is there's a guy named Richard Thaler at the University of Chicago who's one of the big behavioral economists. And, you know, he tells this great story that he's at a dinner party with him and some other colleagues. And he says, you know, one of his colleagues, who's this big, fancy guy who believes in rational agent theory, starts talking about what idiot people are. You know, his wife is an idiot because she doesn't make these rational economic decisions. She's bought this new car, but she never takes it out of the garage because she doesn't want to ding it. And his students are such idiots because, you know, they can't understand the most basic economic theories. And at that point, another person who's at the dinner party, a psychologist, says, how come all the people in your models are geniuses, but all the people you know in real life are idiots? And at that point, the economist gets very uncomfortable and proceeds to do what Richard Thaler calls the invisible hand wave, where he starts talking about, well, the market figures it out all in the end, blah, 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 blah. And this is really the place that academia has reached, is that it's very clear, if you go to an adjacent field of thinking, that many of the assumptions in that field don't make sense. But the academics in that field obviously have a vested interest in defending their existing ideas. So we think that, you know, in practice, the world is all connected. Like, these divisions between disciplines like economics, neuroscience, and psychology are created to sort of make the problem of figuring out reality more manageable. But the problem is that you actually can't make sense of any one piece of reality without looking at what's going on elsewhere. And academics already realize this problem. They talk about interdisciplinary work, and there is some interdisciplinary work going on. But in practice, the structure of academia, the egos that are involved, and just the writing style of academic papers means that it's a very, very slow process. And we think that it can be done much more quickly in the informal environment of the internet and the podcasting community in much the same way that Wikipedia outcompeted the Encyclopedia Britannica.
So let me push on to the point I was about to make before I let you get a word in. Yeah, it's all good. So I think of different mental styles. Say one element that you would need to incorporate into your mix has got to be logic. If you don't know logic, it's basically like going into the octagon not knowing any Brazilian jiu-jitsu or any submission work. You're just going to get worked over. There, you got to have it. But by itself, it's not enough. So you need some other style of thinking, or some other styles of communication, or other styles of persuasion. So, you know, there is this ancient mental art called rhetoric, and rhetoric is not the same as logic. Rhetoric is the art of using your words and your presentation to convince people, and some of the rhetorical styles and tricks are pretty illogical, you know, but they work. So there's logic, there's rhetoric. What else do you need? Well, humor, it seems, works really well. So as you probably well know, being connected to somebody who is well known for his comedic acumen, it goes a long way in hooking people's attention and creating goodwill. So there are a few things. Now, if you want to be a mixed martial arts fighter, there is very little reason to study capoeira, or very little reason to study taekwondo or Shaolin kung fu. I mean, these are things that sort of went by the wayside when those early UFC events demonstrated that there's some martial arts which had been respected in the past which really don't cash out too much in terms of practical value in the ring against a knowledgeable and fit opponent. So I think in the mental realm, there's a lot of stuff like that. You know, there are a lot of mental equivalents to capoeira. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. If there are things, elements that you see people appealing to, which probably should be removed from the repertoire of the mixed mental artist.
Well, I mean, the crucial word there is practicality, right? And that's what is so great about this metaphor is that ultimately it's like something can look fancy in isolation, but then what does it actually allow you to do in reality once you step into the octagon? And I think that, I come from the world of academia, and a lot of these theories are just going to die. And in practice, many of them, based on the evidence, a lot of, for example, psych, has already died based on the evidence alone, but there are powerful people who defend it. I don't know that, for example, a lot of traditional economics is actually very useful. I think a lot of it, when you put it up against what we actually know about how humans behave and how they think, I think a lot of it will freaking die, because you can make, economics, a lot of it comes out of this insecurity about the desire to make the dismal science economics into something pretty and pure. And so they come up with these fantastic mathematical abstractions that don't actually work very well in practice. Racism is an idea that obviously has a lot of popular appeal, but if you actually look at the genetic data, it's not a useful way of dividing people up. So I think, that's our job, is to break down a lot of these constructs. But in the end, the other great thing about, mixed martial arts is that it's not really about what any one individual thinks. So, I mean, mixed mental arts has already really moved out of my hands, which is awesome as a metaphor. And, I can try, and the point is I don't want to define a new orthodoxy. Like, already I know that I've said these things and people will disagree with them. And that's the great thing, is to really just empower the hashing out of these ideas and then see what emerges and see what evolves. But I think that ultimately the crucial test will be, what does it practically do for people, and how does it help them, improve their own personal experience and ultimately create a more satisfying, more equitable, more inclusive society?
Well, you talk about practicality and, what works in the real world, and belief systems, one would look at them is to say that they are adapted meme complexes, which is to say they are things that replicate themselves. And they don't necessarily replicate themselves because they are true or because they are useful for the person who holds the belief. So racism is a great example. You see, it doesn't hold up very well to what we know about race and genetics, and the construction of race, but it has an appeal. So it endures, much like this rational agent theory in economics, even though it doesn't match up very well to the real world and, you know, demonstrably so, it still sticks around. So do you have a set of procedures or a line on how to identify these types of memes that get stuck in your head because they appeal to something about your psychology, but they're definitely not good for you, and they're not anything that you would consciously want to propagate if you were thinking carefully about who benefits?
Yeah, and it mostly comes down to being, you know, emotionally honest with yourself and reflecting on what is it doing for you. So, for example, I have relatives who make racist jokes all the time. And I think most of what it does for them psychologically is, you know, it makes them feel like an iconoclast. They're saying the things you're not supposed to say. They're pushing people's buttons. And if that's the real satisfaction that you're deriving from racism, well, there are other ways to derive that. Like, you know, there are other orthodoxies to challenge. And I think most of it comes down to emotional honesty. Like, what psychological need is this particular idea delivering for me? So, for example, a lot of, you know, cultures, you know, the reason why people buy into them, even if a culture is destructive, is because ultimately it's about belonging. You know, we go along to get along, and we want to fit in, we want to have a sense of community. And I would say that any community that requires you to go along with destructive ideas as a way to gain acceptance is not a community that is really looking out for you. And part of the role of mixed mental arts is to create a community of people where, you know, what we value is, you know, not adherence to some sort of traditional way of thinking, but a desire to seek. And so you can have that belonging, and you can have that community, and you can come and figure things out with us. But I think, again, that you can't really solve any of these things until you're really honest about the fact that humans are primates and we have emotional and psychological needs that come down to that primate nature. And particularly, I mean, for humans especially, you know, we are the hypersocial ape. So you really have to figure out what are the social mechanisms that are driving people's adherence to these beliefs.
You've mentioned the word community a couple times, and you also mentioned that the metaphor of mixed mental arts is out of your hands at this point. Would you talk about the community that has grown up around mixed mental arts?
Yeah, so, you know, 9 months ago I was on Joe Rogan, and, you know, Joe Rogan is really, for people who aren't in the podcast community, the best way to think of Joe Rogan is that he's Bropra. You know, he's the titanic force within the podcast community, has an audience in the tens of millions. And so if, you know, Oprah created Oprah moments, Joe creates Bropra moments. And so, you know, going on Joe, you just get a huge amount of attention. And essentially, I found that, you know, I said various things on Joe. I was getting a lot of positive support. I was also getting a bunch of pushback. And I just realized that, you know, it was going to take far more than me to sort of help humanity work through a lot of these ideas and really to evolve this thinking style. And so 9 months ago, I really just, anybody who was there, who was engaged and who was interested, I said, come play with us. Come help us evolve this mixed mental arts. And, you know, there are a bunch of things that have come out of that. You know, there's a Facebook group, there's a Reddit, and then there's a group of, you know, 20 or so really active people who have helped evolve a mixed mental arts belt system, which is basically to take, you know, one of the big challenges is that we have 130 million books in the world. We have 60 million scientific papers. We have, you know, God knows how many hours of content, blog posts, videos, and to whittle that down to 9 core principles about how humans work. And so now there's a group of people that have helped do this. And that's really what we're doing now, is we're just encouraging more and more people to get involved and to help evolve this thing. But it has already evolved to something with this belt system and what's going on in that Facebook group and what's going on in general that is well beyond anything that I could ever claim credit for. And so, you know, and I'm just excited. I mean, I think most of my job is to really midwife this and to help facilitate and empower these conversations.
I think it was Socrates who claimed to be a midwife to wisdom. that he didn't make it. He just helped it, you know, come into the world. He's also the wise person who said that he didn't know anything.
Yeah, and I think you can't go, I mean, you know, I've been tutoring for the last 13 years to pay my bills. And, you know, more and more I just realized that Socrates figured it out 2,000 years ago. You know, I mean, Socrates' mother was a midwife. And so he really understood that process that, you know, that baby was coming and that you could ease it and you could facilitate it. And that is very much the experience of tutoring, is just that, you know, your job is not to tell the student what to think. That's indoctrination. That's putting a doctrine in. Your job is to educate, educare, to lead out. And that is really midwifing. It's really the Socratic method is you're asking questions, you're sparking reflection, you're getting the student to think for themselves. You're holding up two dots next to each other and then letting them see the dots and then saying, do you see a connection here? And that's really your job, is to sort of curate the information space around the kid to help them form their own conclusions. But it is a process of midwifing. And what I've realized is that what I've been doing for a long time on an individual level is really what we need on a global level. You know, there is a global culture that is coming. That baby is coming. But it is a process of midwifing. And what I've realized is that what I've been doing for a long time on an individual level is really what we need on a global level. You know, there is a global culture that is coming. That baby is coming. And, you know, some people want to fight that baby and shove it back in the uterus. But I think we're far better off midwifing it and just helping it come into being.
So you've mentioned education and tutoring. You are the co-author of a book on that topic. Would you say a few words about that?
Yeah, so, you know, I started a tutoring company after college because that's what people who went to fancy schools who have no idea what to do with their life do.
For a time.
You can make a pretty good living. Yeah, for a time. and you can make a pretty good living doing that. And we were doing that. But again, you know, a lot of tutoring creates a culture of dependency. And what you're doing is that you're trying to make the kid and the family more and more dependent on you. And, you know, along with the people who I started this tutoring company with, one of whom is from Vermont, from the Northeast Kingdom, Bud Vanna, you know, we just didn't like that at all. We didn't feel that was a tutor's job. And so our whole thing was to basically put ourselves out of a job. A tutor is supposed to be training wheels. You're supposed to provide the support and structure. You know, we just didn't like that at all. We didn't feel that was a tutor's job. And so our whole thing was to basically put ourselves out of a job. A tutor is supposed to be training wheels. You're supposed to provide the support and structure to get the kid working independently and to build those tools and build those competencies so ultimately you get fired. And so that's what we were doing. And then out of that work we were doing, you know, we were writing the manual for that tutoring company. This is Katie O'Brien and I, who is from New Hampshire. I mean, there's just a really strong New Hampshire, Vermont contingent here. And, you know, at some point I turned to Katie and I was like, I think we should make this a book. And so we decided to write a book. And the name of that book was The Straight A Conspiracy. And the whole thing was that, you know, we just realized that humans think magically and kids have a lot of magical thinking about how learning and how intelligence and how getting good grades works. And so the real point of the Straight A Conspiracy is to get kids past that magical thinking and towards a real understanding of what are the steps and what are the mechanisms by which you can teach yourself anything that's required.
So this is a book actually written for students?
Yep, because so much of what happens is that you have these conversations with parents. And then now you saddled the parent who is already having a tough time talking about school with the difficulty of now relaying all that information to the kid who potentially is tuning them out and not really listening. So we decided that we should write it straight to the disgruntled teenager. And we were lucky enough to, one of the parents of our students was Stan Rogo, who was one of the creators of Lizzie McGuire, the Hillary Duff show. And, you know, we sat down with Stan and we were like, we're having a really tough time titling this book. And Stan, you know, we literally wrestled for years with the title of the book. And then Stan solved the problem in half an hour. And he basically said, you know, I've spent my whole career making TV for kids. And the one thing I know about teenagers is their lives suck. They may not suck in any sort of objective sense, any geographical sense, any historical sense, but on an emotional, subjective level, they suck. And so the one thing that kids will always believe is that they've been lied to. And so your book is the something conspiracy. Don't know what it is, but it's the something conspiracy. And so that's how we came up with the straight A conspiracy. And what we realized that what Stan was doing, which was so emotionally smart, is that we, you know, and a lot of educators do this. You spend your time trying to get kids to believe in themselves. But that doesn't feel true to them. Like, you tell a kid you can do anything you put your mind to, and that doesn't feel true for a teenager. So what Stan realized is that we had to get them not to believe in themselves, but to doubt their own doubts, and to basically follow that doubt through until ultimately, when you doubted your own doubts, you came out on the other side believing in yourself.
Well, my oldest son is 16. He'll be 17 next month. He is a junior in high school, and I think he's going to be getting this book in the mail pretty soon.
Sounds excellent. And if there's anything that I can do to support you and your son with that, just let me know.
So one thing that I've told my son a few times, now he doesn't live with me, so he lives in a different state with his mother, and I don't have that many opportunities, you know, to drop parental wisdom on him, which is probably for the best. He probably thinks more of me, you know, the less of that he gets. But the thing that I have tried to communicate to him a few times is that adults who care about you and want the best for you will lie to you. And the only reason anybody ever lies to you is because they want you to behave differently than you would if you knew the truth. Mm-hmm. Or they want you to have a better opinion of them than you would if you knew the truth, which probably comes down to, you know, some behavioral consequences as well. So those are a couple of messages that I have tried to impart to both my kids. I think the younger one, he was a little too young for that message when I was giving it to his brother, and I haven't gotten around to giving it to him. But I thought of all that because of your mention of conspiracy, and, you know, why conspiracy is such a great hook for this book about learning. So I invite you to talk about the conspiracy, why conspiracies appeal to us, why they are so mimetically successful.
Yeah, I mean, so the I think the thing is that, you know, humans in general, like, there's a Joe Henrich's The Secret of Our Success, which is really about, like, why did humans outpace all the other animals on the planet, and I just think is a book that everybody should read. But
what's the title again?
There's a graph in The Secret of Our Success.
Great.
And there's a graph in the beginning of that where you give an intelligence test to a chimpanzee, an orangutan, and a human toddler. And I have some bad news, KMO. We don't do that well. you know, chimps actually have better spatial reasoning, they have better quantitative reasoning, and they're better at figuring out causality, why things happen. There's only one area in which humans are off the chart smart, and that's social intelligence. We are incredibly socially intelligent from birth, and that's why we're so good at learning from each other, so good at, you know, picking up culture, all of that, and that is really the secret of our success. But I think so much of it comes down to the fact that we're bad at figuring out why things happen, and we're amazing at social intelligence. So when things aren't working, the place that our minds love to go is to some sort of social cause, that there are some group of individuals who are up to some sort of nefarious plot, and that's why things have happened. And the problem is that you know, that's generally not how things work. I find Hanlon's razor to be a pretty good rule of thumb. So people generally know Occam's razor, which is that all things being equal, the simplest explanation is the truth. Hanlon's razor is that you should never attribute to malice what can be explained by stupidity. And so, you know, the more you dig around, the more you come to realize that there isn't some nefarious cabal of people who are conspiring to achieve something or against you. I mean, those do exist, but that a lot of time it's just, you know, bureaucracy, incompetence, short-sightedness, and just sort of, you know, petty focus. But the point is that it is because our minds love soap operas. You know, that's really a lot of what conspiracies are. They're soap operas where, you know, there's something that's not working in the world. We can't figure out why. And then we imagine, you know, that there is some group of, you know, master scientists, Jews, you know, secret Nazis who still exist in Argentina, who are plotting some sort of giant master plan and pulling the puppet strings.
Says the son of a banker who says we shouldn't worry about international global conspiracies of Jewish bankers.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. And there you go. Right there, you can already feel the human mind building out like a giant potential conspiracy where, like, you know, I mean, this is really exciting. I'm excited for my new role as apologist of bankers. And, you know, I'm so committed to the role that I live in a fairly boring apartment in Los Angeles, not in some sort of, you know, mountainside retreat somewhere. I mean, that's how evil these bankers are. They're willing to, like, if they, you know, they're, if obviously they sort of fake fairly modest circumstances.
Well, I'm sure you keep that modest apartment, but you also have a big palatial suite in the mountainside, you know, redoubt.
That's exactly right. And I actually have multiple body doubles who have all had plastic surgery to look like me. And in fact, I'm in the mountainside retreat, but one of the body doubles is in my Los Angeles apartment, lip syncing everything that I'm saying to maintain the facade and the illusion.
Even though we're on radio and I can't see you at all.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the level that they're willing to go to. You know, this shit's deep. Excuse me, I'm not supposed to swear.
That one's okay. The big F-bomb is the real no-no.
It's the real, yeah, it's the no-no. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that's the point. And I think the other thing, too, we actually had Joe Shinsky on Mental Arts, who actually studies conspiracy theories. And, you know, conspiracy theories exists on, you know, in every political subculture you can imagine. And obviously the boogeymen change, but it's just a really, really common feature. And one of the big insights that he had from all of that research is the fact that conspiracies appeal to the powerless because it comes out of these feelings of not having control over your destiny and feeling that things are being done to you by other people. So I think it's, you know, a lot of it is that those feelings of powerless really sort of cause you to imagine something. And I think the other thing that's important to recognize here as well is the Dunbar number. So, you know, every animal has a natural group size. So, you know, there's a natural size for a troop of baboons. There's a natural size for, you know, a pack of wolves. And there's obviously some flexibility there, but, you know, there's a sort of a, it doesn't, you're not going to find a pack of, I say this now, there was actually at some point in Siberia, this super pack of wolves formed because essentially circumstances were so scarce that like they banded together, but that's highly unusual. The Dunbar number is basically the, what seems to be the cognitive limit for humans, that a natural human tribal size across cultures is about 150. Past that, social cohesion starts to break down because we can't really track all the relationships very well. And so, you know, we now live in societies that are so far beyond the Dunbar number. So if you imagine in a tribe of 150, you know, there are maybe things that are being done to me by, you know, Jeff, right? And I can see Jeff, or even in a high school, right? There's a jock, he bullies me, I know the guy who is bullying me, I feel those feelings of helplessness, and I am angry at that guy. But now, you know, I am, you know, perhaps, you know, living in circumstances I don't like. I'm poor. I don't have a good place to live. You know, I can't find a girlfriend, and I don't see who's doing this to me, right? Like, it's very hard for me to track how mortgage rates and large macroeconomic decisions and whatever foreign policy decisions are leading to my current circumstances. And so my mind fills in and comes up with these explanations. And, you know, because humans have this weak causal intelligence, we create magical thinking everywhere. I mean, one of my all-time favorites is there was this series of shark attacks at this beach in Egypt. And, you know, because it's the Arab world, you know, the favorite boogeyman is always Israel and Mossad. So their minds fill in, and the conclusion they come to is that Mossad has been genetically engineering sharks to attack Egyptian lizards, right? Like super sharks, like Deep Blue Sea. And, you know, which probably some of them had seen that, and that also factored into their thinking. And the local imam was like, this is too rich even for the local imam. And he was like, listen, guys, it was just Eid. We did just like slaughter a bunch of sheep and then dump all their blood guts into the waters by this beach. And maybe that wasn't such a good idea. We essentially chummed up the waters.
Yay, imam.
But, you know, yeah, exactly, for calling his own people out. And, you know, the point is that, I mean, you know, people feel these feelings of helplessness. They don't necessarily have a great education or a great causal understanding of these things. And then, you know, there are always, like, every culture has preferred boogeymen where, you know, if you've got liberals, they, you know, love to blame big corporations. If you've got libertarians, they love to blame the government. And it's just always you return to that. It's the Arabs, you know, it's the Jews. You know, if it's the Jews, I don't know, who did the Jews blame? But the...
I'll ask when I get
home.
There
are... Yeah, exactly. But there are these stock characters that, you know, in the sort of soap operas of our lives and our worldviews, we return to again and again. Oh, it's them, you know. And it is very often these middleman minorities like the Jews, the overseas Chinese, the Armenians, the Indians in East Africa, who, because they're wealthy, visible, a small minority, they just are routinely used as scapegoats.
Here's something you don't have to do in podcasting. You are listening to Sea Realm Radio on 91.5 WOOL, Bellows Falls, Vermont. I'm KMO, and I'm speaking with Hunter Motz of Mixed Mental Arts, and you can find that at mixedmentalarts.co. What is this CO business? Why isn't it .com?
Because some Polish guy bought mixedmentalarts.com.
Oh.
And we've reached out to him repeatedly to try and get it, but you know, he's radio silent. And you know, I mean, I probably shouldn't be saying this on air, but we're just really rooting for it to lapse in June so we can snap it up. But you know, now, I mean, you know, probably there's like a small Polish enclave in Vermont or New Hampshire who are going to hear this and then, you know, call up their cousin in Poland and be like, dude, hold on to this sucker.
Jack up the price.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, yes. Well, hey, we've been running this as a typical interview thus far. Let's break out of that mode. We can just converse. Is there anything on your mind that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think, you know, I really enjoyed, so if for listeners, I mean, we haven't released it yet, but we had KMO on Mixed Mental Arts. Which was a real treat for KMO because you got to talk to Brian Callen, who's a huge star. But
I have never seen the Hangover or what was the other thing you said he was in?
Oh my God. Thank God Brian isn't here. It was old school Entourage. You know, he has
right.
A storied and very varied career.
He hasn't been in science fiction, I guess, because I'm a science fiction nerd.
Oh, really? Well,
yeah.
Listen, there's now that Star Trek is back on the air, I mean, I personally would love to see Brian Callen in the new series of Star Trek.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, maybe or Rick and Morty. There you go. I think Rick and Morty may be more likely. but you know, we had that conversation. I mean, you know, tribute to the Wisdom of Crowds and, you know, a whole bunch of people basically tried to set us up on a date. I think Ray Baskerville, and then
shout out.
The Maidstone Skeptics. And I think that's, you know, part of what's really cool is that, you know, because we have the internet, like, you know, I don't think that either of us had heard of each other. You apparently had never heard of Brian Callen, which is shocking to me. And then, you know, there are all these people out there who are listening who then connect the dot thing of the global village. Like, that's what these tools make possible. And so I think that's what's interesting is that we are living in this time where, you know, essentially that social intelligence, that hive mind is really sorting itself out. And, you know, we play different roles within that play. But I'd love to think about, ask you about what you think is going to sort of emerge from, like, do you feel like technology has sort of, you know, creates inexorable pressures? Do you feel like there is somewhere that this is all headed?
Well, somewhere where this is all headed, I don't believe in destinations, basically. I don't believe in ends justifies the means mentalities, because there is no end. You know, you can pick any point in time and say, okay, this is the, here's the development I was talking about back in the past, but it's not the end. There's going to be a tomorrow. So, I don't think there's some place where this is all going. I'm not a teleologist or an eschatologist or anything like that. But I do think that there are pressures that are novel that communications and information technology, particularly social media, put on us, which we have not figured out how to deal with yet. So I think that particularly Facebook, I mean, I recently read a book called Everybody Lies, and the author talked about, and I say I read it, I actually listened to the audiobook while I was driving, and when I got finished with it, I wished that I had read it, because I would have highlighted all kinds of stuff, and I would have had, you know, access to go back to that and find those things that I really found important. And it doesn't work that way with an audiobook. But putting that aside, this author was saying that the Google search box is the ultimate truth machine, in that you will type into that box what you really want, and your honesty is rewarded with content that is tailored to your actual desires. And Facebook is the exact opposite. Facebook is the ultimate, not the ultimate, but the Facebook is definitely a moral hazard, in that it encourages you to present yourself as a brand, you know, to present yourself in the most appealing and you know, anodyne sort of way, unless, of course, you're going for iconoclasm. But it encourages you to demonstrate that you hold the right values, so you get a lot of virtue signaling. And it also encourages people to really strongly identify with their ideologies and to be champions of their ideologies. And to it amplifies the unfortunate human tendency to identify with our thoughts and belief systems, so that if somebody says something that we disagree with, on a physiological level, we take that as an assault on our person, and we get a fight or flight response. And I see it happening to myself in that, and I think, you know, we don't have to go down this road conversationally, but I think we're both basically on the same page in that we don't see the social justice warrior phenomenon as being anything that's really great for society or for humanity. But if you criticize it online, it's very easy to slide into a position where you are basically preaching to the choir, and the choir is the alt-right, and you start getting encouragement from people that you don't want encouragement from and that you don't really want in your life. And so I've said very little on this topic, but it has attracted a few people to the Friends of the Sea Realm community that, you know, I guess I'm glad they're there, because they're representing a minority viewpoint in that community, but they're not anybody whose views I really want to be associated with, you know? So I'm talking about the alt-right, the white nationalists, the really sort of push back against feminism, red pill, you know, community. Even though I realize there's something of value in all of those, it's really difficult to wade into those waters and emerge anything other than just covered in slime.
Well, and I think the challenge as well, right, is that, and this is something that we've, you know, struggled with and dealt with in the mixed mental arts community, is that, you know, you want intellectual diversity, but what you're really trying to create with, you know, something like the Sea Realm community or the Mixed Mental Arts Facebook group or anything in general, is you're trying to create an ecosystem. And you want enough diversity there that you can spark interesting conversations, but, you know, it can very easily turn into a monoculture. And, you know, somebody actually, Dustin Cubitt, posted in the Mixed Mental Arts Facebook group yesterday that people should avoid at all costs the Jordan Peterson Facebook group.
And, I saw that.
You know, Jordan, yeah. I mean, Jordan, you know, has obviously spoken out. If, for people who don't know, Jordan Peterson is a professor at the University of Toronto, and there were various speech laws on the books in Canada that were designed to I think make it hate speech if you use pronouns other than the ones that people wanted to use. And so Jordan spoke out about this. We actually had Jordan on the Mixed Mental Arts podcast, and then Brian shared that with Joe Rogan. Jordan Peterson had his bro for a moment, and then, you know, he's gotten like all sorts of attention from that. And, you know, what's happened, though, is that, you know, I mean, Jordan has ended up becoming this lightning rod for the alt-right and for a lot of those people. And so I think there are the conversations that Jordan would like to have. And I mean, the conversations that Jordan does have and the sort of thoughtful analysis he does about, you know, religion and what all these myths mean and what they're really teaching us in psychology. But then in practice, you know, he just gets a lot of the alt-right Kekistan crowd. And I mean, that I think is the real challenge is, yeah, how do you create better platforms and how do you create communities that are working towards the sort of goals that you actually care about rather than becoming the poster boy for something you don't like at all, but that it's very hard to dissociate from that, and then that becomes your bread and butter. I mean, Jordan makes, I don't remember how much on Patreon, but tens of thousands, maybe even $100,000 a month.
So he doesn't want to alienate that audience.
Well, or he doesn't, I don't know if he's dealt with it or how to deal with it or whether he thinks he can challenge the frustrations of that audience towards something more productive. Because I think that's the other thing, too, is that, you know, I mean, obviously, and this is sort of what we've talked about a little bit offline, like a lot of these phenomena are very much the same thing. It's the same thing as, you know, what goes on with Islamic fundamentalism. You have young men who don't know how to get laid and don't know how to get paid, so they don't have a good path to dignity. And then the existing system isn't working for them, and so then frustrated, what other alternative is there? And if, you know, in the Middle East, it's Islamic fundamentalism. That's the, you know, if you're angry, horny, and not making money, that's where you turn to. And then, you know, in the United States, a lot of it is the alt-right. And, you know, there's an ideology there that somehow you believe is going to solve your problems, deals with your frustrations. But that's not, I mean, fundamentalism is not a destination. It's not that you have to stay stuck there. I mean, a lot of what we've talked about in the Mixed Mental Arts Facebook group is that a lot of us, when, you know, we were 19, 20, were total boneheads. And, you know, you sort of latch on to something. For me, it was science and academia. For other people, it was libertarianism or anarcho-capitalism. You know, for other people, it was sort of anti-theism. And you're like, this is it. This is the answer. Like, I now know everything. And then you proceed to just parrot a series of ideas that you watched on YouTube. Yeah. And Drew Sample, who's in the mixed mental arts community and hosts a podcast called The Sample Hour, is very good about talking about how, you know, that was, for him, it was really libertarianism. And now he goes to these events, you know, with these anarchists and, you know, they're just like, he literally hears them parroting some YouTube videos that he watched a few years ago. It's like, I literally know which video you're repeating. And if you've got young guys or young gals who are in that place, you know, it's not that they have to stay there. It's like, okay, you're angry. Like, what's your anger about? Like, let's see if we can evolve you through this phase to something more productive. So, I mean, I think it's possible that, you know, maybe Jordan is hopeful that he can help evolve people through that. I think regardless, that's a lot of what we have to help people do is, you know, help them essentially de-radicalize and, you know, like incorporate what their frustrations are and say, yes, you have a point. Like, that's a totally valid point. But, you know, let's see if we can evolve to a more nuanced, productive worldview that more people can get on board with.
Just filling in some coincidences. When I first got the email from Ray saying, hey, you should get in touch with this Hunter guy and get on his show, I was traveling and I had my son with me and we were driving and I pulled over at a rest stop. In fact, I don't read my email while driving. I read the email at the rest stop. But I called up your podcast feed and I just handed the phone to my son and I said, here, pick an episode that you think looks interesting. We'll listen to that. And that's when I discovered that my son is a big Jordan Peterson fan. I had never heard him mention the name before, but that's the episode that he picked. So that was the first episode of Mixed Mental Arts that I heard was you guys talking to Jordan Peterson.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think for me, like, obviously the social justice warrior thing and all of this pronoun stuff has gotten a lot of attention. And, you know, I mean, I think it sort of shows the silly place that academia has reached in many respects. But, you know, this is sort of the basic problem is that, you know, so much of what the internet and social media has become is this, you know, it draws heavily on the emotion of outrage. And, you know, there are things that are outrage the right. There are things that outrage the left. You know, there's a war on Christmas, Starbucks, you know. It draws heavily on the emotion of outrage. And, you know, there are things that are outrage the right. There are things that outrage the left. You know, there's a war on Christmas, Starbucks, you know. So, I mean, but that's not the, I think, the sort of emotions that we really need to be focused on and the cognitive states that we need to be focused on. And so there's no doubt that, you know, you can make a good living and get a lot of attention for appealing to that in one particular tribe or another. But I think that what we really have to start to do is to move past that and just be like, okay, it's time to do the actual work of figuring out our problems and figuring out how to reach across party lines and do a lot more slow thinking where we're actually puzzling out solutions to our problems. But, you know, there is, I 100% understand the appeal of those sorts of narratives. And I'm sure that if I was, you know, 14, 15 years younger, that I would be in the Jordan Peterson Facebook group ranting and raving about, you know, 70 pronouns being ridiculous.
So we've got less than 8 minutes left in the program. So it's, I think, safe now to bring this one off the shelf. I've seen a video of you on the Joe Rogan program, and you had some criticisms of Sam Harris, and Joe just kept asking you to boil down your criticism and present it in a short way that he could understand, and your answers were very long and discursive. And I wonder if you've had some time to give that some thought, and do you have a short synopsis of your criticism of Sam Harris?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they were long and discursive, and, you know, I'm a recovering academic, and so that's part of why. The other thing, too, is that, you know, I mean, Joe was clearly upset, and, you know, I got very uncomfortable. But it's very simple. You know, ultimately, Sam has built a career off of railing against Islamic fundamentalism, and Sam is a fundamentalist. And the key thing is understanding, you know, human psychology. And the fundamentalist mindset, it's not about any one ideology. It is about the psychology, and it is about this righteous mind, rather than, you know, the self-reflective mind. And the reason why someone like Ray Baskerville is saying that, you know, you and I should talk is because we spend our time trying to find the problems in our own thinking rather than trying to find the problems in other people's thinking. And what we, I think, have to realize in terms of moving towards those more productive conversations is that fundamentalists of different tribes are allies. So Jordan Peterson draws his power from the insanity of social justice warriors. If there are no insane social justice warriors, then Jordan Peterson can't talk about that. If there are no Islamic fundamentalists, then Sam Harris doesn't have anything to talk about. And, you know, this became clear to me because I tutored at Oaks Christian, which was a school that was set up to teach creationism. And I'd never really thought about the new atheists very much. Like, I read Richard Dawkins' books as a kid. But, like, they talked endlessly at Oaks Christian about the new atheists as basically, like, this is what a scientist looks like. And they're very arrogant and they don't really understand our religion. And so it's just time to realize that while someone like Sam Harris may represent one thing to Joe, that he's actually being used to fuel the conflict on the other side. And that, you know, the whole thing that I was trying to do was just to help people realize that, you know, if we focus on ideology, then yes, all these fundamentalists are very different. But if we focus on psychology and we focus on how they draw their power, that they're actually in the same boat and that we're actually going to have much more, we're going to make much more progress by people of different political stripes who come from the sort of reflective, reasonable place that I think we come from, hashing out their differences, than in aligning ourselves with this or that, you know, public figure who is driving outrage about what some other group is doing.
So I'm not going to be his champion here because he doesn't need one. He's got a very successful podcast and, you know, he's written books and he gets paid to just basically stand on stage and opine. So, but I will say that, you know, I do listen to the Sam Harris podcast regularly. And the whole, you know, railing against Islam thing is, it's maybe a sixth of what he does. Maybe a seventh now that Trump has been elected, because railing against Trump is his new pastime. And I think he rightly understands that a good portion of his audience, me included, is tired of it. I mean, you don't need to spend more than 30 seconds criticizing Trump for me to say, yes, I get it. I get it. He's the worst. But I'm not interested in the details so much.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the point is that that's how he built his fame, and obviously his brand has evolved, right? Like, you know, because, you know, he obviously, you know, his mother created the Golden Girls. He understands you have to turn the story. And so, you know, the story is not like if he just was talking about Islam all the time, then, you know, his story would get boring. And so now he's turned it to Trump. Now Trump has gotten boring, and now he has to find other things. And, you know, that's his content plan. You know, that's great for him. But, you know, the other part of it is, too, is that, you know, Dawkins and Harris have really portrayed their view of evolution and their view of science as, you know, the definitive science. And there's actually a whole bunch of science that doesn't fit with them. For example, the work of Joe Henrich, you know, Sam Harris had Charles Murray on and then tried to persuade the world that Charles Murray was definitive accepted science. But we actually know, like Sam made a point to go on Joe Rogan and say that I didn't know the relevant biology. Well, we actually know that Sam hasn't read the relevant biology, because one of the things in the Charles Murray interview was about how you know, there's this thing called the Flynn effect, where IQ scores have gone up over time, but we don't know why they've gone up. Actually, we do. Like, it exists. You know, you can read The Secret of Our Success, and you can find out that the answer is cumulative cultural evolution. But the point is that, you know, Sam has, you know, as you say, he has a very successful podcast. And that's the basic thing, is that the attention is going towards this guy who has managed to draw all this attention to himself rather than the vast majority of people. And it's the same thing in Islam. You know, in the Islamic community, in the Islamic information space, these fundamentalists have managed to draw all the attention towards themselves rather than focusing on what the real issues are in the Arabic world, which is corruption.
Hey, Hunter, I never do this, but I want to stop you, interrupt you there. We've got just about a minute left, and I'd rather end on a more positive note than that. So if you can condense it into a minute, would you talk about, just give us your elephant metaphor.
Yeah, so it's the, do you mean the blind man and the elephant?
The elephant being the emotions that get directed by...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
This is John Hyde's metaphor, actually, which he just says that, you know, the mind is like a rider and an elephant. And so you have this large, lumbering elephant that is the emotional systems of the brain, and then there is the rider, who is this small, reflective individual who can steer the elephant. And, you know, it takes a long time to redirect our emotions. But, you know, if the rider can patiently keep nudging the elephant, then over time we can train our brains to go in a different direction. Obviously, that's so much of what your journey and my journey has been, Camo, is taking decades to slowly start to train our elephants to go in more productive directions.
stubborn elephants, but very smart and very powerful.
Yep.
Well, exactly. Hey, we should wrap it up here, but I will repeat, because I can't repeat a guest's name often enough. I've been talking with Hunter Maats, that's M-A-A-T-S, and you can find Hunter and the entire mixed martial arts community on Facebook, but also there's a website. It is mixedmentalarts.co. So, dude in Poland, don't listen to this and don't renew your claim on that that website domain. All right. Well, we are just about out of time, so I do need to say goodbye. This is live radio, and we have a hard stop coming up in about 10 seconds. So thanks so much, Hunter.
The thing that I should say is...
Oh, go ahead. Quick. All right.
Oh, there is an official Mixed Mental Arts feed on iTunes.
Too late. Sorry.
Follow the official one.
WOOLFM 91.5 Bellows Falls, Community Radio for the Southern Vermont and New Hampshire borderlands. See our full broadcast schedule online at wool.fm or request one by leaving a message at 802-460-WOOL.